It is Monday, September 12th here in Washington, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin. Coming up, a health scare forces U.S. Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton out of the spotlight for a few days. We'll find out how it's affecting her campaign. U.S. election watchers also are getting anxious about the prospect of Russian hackers manipulating votes. A Korea analyst tells us why Pyongyang's latest nuclear weapons test appears to be its biggest to date. We'll look at how global warming is causing drastic changes to marine life, and hard times for some of the world's Muslims forces modifications to a holiday tradition. It's all ahead on International Edition. U.S. Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton is skipping a campaign trip to the western state of California after being diagnosed with pneumonia. The diagnosis came to light after Clinton made an early exit from a 9/11 memorial event in New York and was seen stumbling into a car. VOA correspondent Catherine Gibson has been following the story, and I asked her how Clinton's illness is affecting the Democratic nominee's campaign.
Well, we know that she's actually gone home to Chappaqua, New York for a couple of days to recover from what the doctors are saying is a fairly serious case of pneumonia. And we know that her daughter, Chelsea, will be out on the campaign trail for her in Ohio, taking her place, kind of taking up the issues.
So she's got some surrogates helping her out.
She absolutely does.
And what about her schedule? How did it affect Hillary Clinton's own campaign schedule for this week?
Well, she's taking the 2 days off, so we know that she was supposed to go to California, and we've switched so that her surrogates are taking over in Ohio for those 2 days.
Her campaign has faced some criticism for not disclosing her pneumonia diagnosis earlier. It said she had been diagnosed with that illness on Friday, but didn't declare that until Sunday after she had a near fainting spell in New York. So how is the campaign responding to criticism that it's not being transparent enough?
Well, that's really interesting because it does really go to the heart of some of the issues that people have brought up about Hillary Clinton and her candidacy is that she has this lack of transparency. So we know that when she was at the 9/11 memorial on Sunday, she had that kind of fainting spell, and it was initially said that it was very hot out. And then it eventually came out that she had been diagnosed with pneumonia. So really this fact that her campaign couldn't get the timeline and the story straight really opens her up to renewed criticism about her lack of transparency.
Well, how has her campaign rival Donald Trump been responding to Hillary's illness?
It was a very interesting response from Donald Trump this time around. He was actually very mild-mannered for him. He wished her well, said that he hoped that she was recovered in time for the debates. And then he came back and hit her on another issue that Hillary Clinton had over this weekend, which is her comment about Donald Trump supporters being deplorables. So this was a really interesting choice from Donald Trump. He could have gone after her on the health issue. That's certainly something that's been raised before. But he chose to go after the more intense political issue where she criticized his own supporters.
But Clinton's supporters also point out that Trump hasn't been super transparent about his own medical situation either. So what is the Trump camp saying about that?
That's right. So they're saying that they are going to release Donald Trump's health records sometime this week on the Dr. Oz show, a popular health show here in the United States, said that he had the physical exam in the recent days. They're just waiting for the final numbers to come in, and then they'll be fully transparent and release them.
Well, how would you say the issue of the candidate's health is affecting the campaign as a whole, because it hasn't really dominated the news cycle up until very recently?
Well, we do have two older candidates, and we all know that a presidential campaign is intensely grueling, that you're constantly out on the campaign trail, you're not sleeping, you're not eating well, you're shaking hands with many people. It's a exhausting process. And the Clinton campaign has actually mentioned that some of her close campaign staffers have gone down with this, quote, debilitating bug as well. So, you have to remember that a presidential campaign can really wear you down.
It looks like it might be doing that in this case. But thank you very much to our VOA correspondent, Catherine Gibson, for filling us in on the health issues on the campaign trail.
Thank you.
Well, let's check on social media reaction to this story and other issues. And Andrew Palchewski is with me in the studio for that. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, Michael. Good to be with you.
Yeah. So what are we seeing regarding social media conversation on Hillary's health?
Well, that's the trending hashtag, actually, is hashtag Hillary's health. And you see kind of these three different camps. Usually we talk about the two different camps that we see in social media. There's the pro-Trump people or the anti-Hillary people on one side, and then you have the pro-Hillary people, anti-Trump people on the other. But this one is a little different.
So what is the third camp?
Well, you have the people on the pro-Trump, anti-Hillary side who are saying, well, she's secretly sick. She's hiding something. Everything from, oh, it's, you know, what other illnesses might she have that are, you know, everything from pneumonia of a deeper or more serious variety to even things as cancer, strokes, you know, they're running the gamut on these speculations. You have that on one side. You have on the other side the pro-Hillary, anti-Trump people who are trying to say, you know what, this is just, leave her be, she's sick. This is, as Catherine just said, something that happens when you're older and you're out on the campaign trail. Even some striking back, I saw one tweet where a Hillary supporter said, finally, the Republicans are talking about women's health. So they're even using it as kind of a campaign issue in some regard.
Okay.
And then that third camp you talked about is the press. Now, the press is reporting on this, but they're also criticizing the Clinton campaign for the secrecy around this announcement of the pneumonia, saying at first that she wasn't feeling well, that she fainted. They didn't announce it, even though it had been diagnosed a couple days prior to her fainting at this 9/11 memorial event. But as one reporter tweeted out, he said it's 24 hours to 48 hours of trouble for the Clinton campaign because you had that deplorables comment, and then you have this. And this case with Hillary's health is two issues that the Clinton campaign have been hammered on repeatedly, which is her health and secrecy. So those two things kind of combined have made this a story that has really popped on social media.
And that's a little unusual for press coverage to be quite critical of Clinton's campaign. Just quickly, you're seeing also some social media talk about a Muslim holiday.
Yes, it's the holiday of Eid. It's one of two Eid holidays. It's the Feast of Sacrifice. So we wish a happy Eid to everyone listening out there. And we're seeing lots of joyful messages on social media as people are celebrating around the world.
Terrific. Thank you so much, Andrew Palchewski. If you want to follow him on Twitter, his handle is at APAL. I'm at Michael_Lippin, and the show is at VOA_IE. Here are some of the top stories right now on VOAnews.com. Car bombing wounds 48 people in southeastern Turkey. Gulf states express concern about U.S. 9/11 attacks legislation. 133 people are killed in North Korean flooding. Syria ceasefire takes effect. And U.S. police say arson is suspected in a fire at a mosque where the Orlando shooter worshipped. Expanded coverage of these stories and more is on voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. South Korean officials say North Korea is preparing to conduct another nuclear test, and it could happen at any time. Monday's warning comes just days after Pyongyang carried out its fifth nuclear detonation. Pyongyang also claimed that it mastered the ability to mount a warhead on a ballistic missile. Troy Stangarone is a Korea analyst at the Washington-based Korea Economic Institute. He told International Edition's Victor Beatty that Friday's nuclear test was the largest by North Korea to date and represents progress in the country's nuclear weapons program.
Now, this does not necessarily mean, as they claim, that they have miniaturized and that they are able to take and mount it on a warhead. There are still reasons to think that may not be the case, but it is disconcerting that they do seem to be making significant progress in terms of upgrading their program. And then when you couple this with the advances they've made with their missile program as well this year, they are progressing much quicker along the path to having a weaponized nuclear weapon than I think many people believe.
Not just the strength of the blast, but the timing also just coming 9 months after one in January.
I think this is the clear indication here, both when you couple the number of missile tests this year or in general under Kim Jong-un, to where his father may have been much more cautious in moving the program forward. He may have actually viewed the program as something which he could use as leverage against other countries. It seems clear that Kim Jong-un is much more interested in getting an actual nuclear weapon that everyone would believe that could be utilized if he so choose to do so. And I think that's the significant difference between him and his father. And it's clearly indicated by not just the progress they made on the tests, but the number of tests they're doing and how frequently they're doing them.
The head of the Washington-based Arms Control Association said North Korea is either at or very close to the point where they can arm short-range ballistic missiles with a nuclear warhead. This obviously is a regional Asian threat.
U.S. intelligence and Japanese intelligence and South Korean intelligence have both, for at least a year or two, thought that they were able to take and do this as well. So now you're seeing outside experts saying, based on what we can see, that that's the case. I think practically speaking, we know that their short-range ballistic missiles, the things that could hit, for example, Tokyo, perhaps Seoul, most likely those would be able to be armed. The real question is, you know, how well they've done the miniaturization side of it. But most likely they could probably take and do that at this point, which is disconcerting because this means that, you know, they do now most likely have an actual usable nuclear weapon.
Now, the North apparently has not yet demonstrated the ability to launch a medium or long-range missile that can re-enter the Earth's atmosphere, and apparently is still years away from having an intercontinental ballistic missile that can deliver a nuclear warhead to hit the continental U.S. Is that your assessment?
The long-range ballistic missiles, the types of things that you might be able to hit Guam or the United States western coast with, are much more difficult. It's actually, in terms of missile technology, relatively speaking, much easier to take and reach orbit. Being able to withstand the stresses of reentry and the heat that's generated from that process is much more difficult. And so until they've actually demonstrated they're able to do that, I think it's unlikely that they're able to actually achieve that.
And that was Troy Stangerone of the Korea Economic Institute speaking with my colleague Victor Beatty. Back to the U.S. election now, and a debate is raging in the United States about how to respond to signs that Russia has been hacking into computer systems used by American political entities. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter has warned Russia not to try to interfere with November's U.S. elections. But Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump says he doubts Russia has been involved in hacking efforts to undermine those elections. VOA's Carolyn Pursuti has more.
The election, the heart of U.S. democracy, is at the center of the debate. But before we tell you how, a little background. The system is decentralized. Votes are collected where people live, and then each state sets up its own security in its own electoral system to tabulate its votes. The method is intended to reduce fraud. So imagine the shock when the FBI told Arizona election officials that Russians had hacked into their system. Experts also blame Russia for hacking into Democratic Party emails.
Tell me about your trip.
A former U.S. ambassador to Georgia and Kazakhstan, William Courtney, writes that Russia will be seen as, quote, a rogue elephant if it continues its disruptions.
Great powers have to work with each other to accomplish objectives. So the United States and China, for example, are working together on the global warming issue. A great power can't exist in isolation.
Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump told an interviewer on a Russian TV network that he doubts Russia was involved.
I think it's probably unlikely.
And Russian President Vladimir Putin denies any connection to the cyber attacks. Democratic Senator Ben Cardin.
You have to believe at the highest levels that these strategies have been agreed to.
The worry now is for any Russian tampering in the general election, which will choose the next U.S. president, Republican Senator Bob Corker.
If they can demonstrate that maybe they affected it so that all of a sudden there's distrust in the outcome, obviously it creates, as it should in our country, instability. So that's a big win for them.
Remember the separate state electoral systems? Courtney suggests the Department of Homeland Security should protect election systems as part of the nation's critical infrastructures.
And that would mean that the U.S. government would be actively involved to encourage those organizations to have good cyber hygiene, to have good antivirus protections and other things.
But it may be too late to do that for the presidential election, now less than 60 days away. In Washington, Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News.
This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Hackers love to target computer networks. That's because their structure usually remains the same over a long period of time. Some IT professionals say they believe an unchanging network configuration gives hackers plenty of time to study and probe it for vulnerabilities. Knowing that a target network will probably remain static for long periods of time, a cyber attacker can be confident enough to launch an assault based on previously gathered information. Information scientists at Pennsylvania State University have come up with a unique way to repel these attacks. They've developed a system that can sense malicious scans from hackers and then deflect them to a virtual decoy network that mimics a real network. This phantom network is isolated and invisible from the real network, but it can fool the hackers into believing they are receiving information about an actual network. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. A new report says global warming is shaking up life in the world's oceans, spreading disease, destroying coral reefs, and threatening to wipe out global food security. 80 scientists from 12 countries released those findings last week at a meeting of the International Union for Conservation of Nature in Honolulu, Hawaii. International Edition's Laurie London talked about the marine impacts of global warming with Pacific Institute oceanographer Susan Meyer.
It's not just a question of changing weather patterns and changing the temperature of the atmosphere. The ocean system and the atmospheric system are this really beautiful coupled physical and biological system that when you change the concentration of greenhouse gases, yes, you do warm the atmosphere, but there are all of these physical, chemical, and biological consequences to those changes. And so we as people are really dependent upon where we find different kinds of ecosystems and where we find different kinds of animals. And as the planet warms, as the chemistry of the ocean changes, animals are experiencing those physical and chemical changes, and they're either going to move to different environments. The habitat that they're dependent upon is going to shrink or change. And so there are all of these ecological consequences that come as a package along with climate warming. And for me, as an oceanographer and a climate scientist, these are unprecedented changes in the history of human use of these kinds of resources. The kind of climatic change that we are precipitating on the global ecosystem is unprecedented in all of Earth's history.
Can you give us some examples of what you mean?
One example is as the planet warms and as the ocean warms, the amount of dissolved oxygen in the interior of the ocean is changing. In a lot of places in the ocean, so we're seeing an expansion of what has been sort of casually called dead zones, but these are really weird and interesting environments that have low dissolved oxygen concentrations, and many, many organisms in the ocean are really sensitive to oxygen. They need oxygen to respire. So as these low oxygen zones expand, we see the reduction of habitat for organisms that respire oxygen. And this has big consequences to the kinds of the sort of carrying capacity that oceans have to sustain productive fisheries. I'll give you another example. As waters warm, the spread of diseases in the marine environment is a part of that story. Marine diseases can be, particularly diseases for like coral reefs, are expanding as waters warm. As animals become closer to their physiological thresholds of tolerance, they become more and more susceptible to disease. So those are just a couple examples. These are really big physical system changes. So we're talking about changing the physical structure of the whole ocean. And there are all of these biological consequences from that they're so big, it's really hard to even hold them in your mind. We're talking about planetary scale change.
And you've been listening to climate scientist and oceanographer Susan Meyer in conversation with International Edition's Laurie London. Muslims around the world are celebrating Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice, which takes place at the end of the Hajj, an annual Islamic pilgrimage to the Saudi city of Mecca. In some places, the holiday is observed on Monday, and in others, on Tuesday. Many Muslims mark Eid al-Adha by slaughtering cattle and preparing the meat for a grand holiday feast in honor of God's generosity. But as VOA's Sladat Sahuk reports, some people cannot afford the price of sacrificed animals.
The cattle markets have been busy in Muslim countries, but just before the holiday, merchants in some countries complained that sales were slow.
It is not a good business. Sometimes we can't afford our family expenses during Eid days. If we sell it now, then we have to sell it very cheap.
But many customers still cannot afford to buy a sacrificial animal. In war-torn Syria, the prices for sheep have skyrocketed.
Last year I could hardly afford it, but now it is very difficult. When I came to ask for the price, I found it very hard. I may cancel the sacrifice.
Nigerian cattle traders say many of their customers now buy an animal together and share the meat.
And instead of a man with a large family buying a ram worth 30,000 naira, he joins hands with his colleagues at work or in the market to buy a bull and get more meat.
Buying meat instead of the whole animal means leaving out the traditional slaughtering ceremony. But as this man in Gabon says, Eid is also about sharing.
If we slit the sheep's throat, we shouldn't keep it for ourselves only. We share with people who can't afford one. You have to give away some of it.
Turkey is taking that obligation seriously and has been sending food, clothing, and other supplies to people in Gaza after making a deal with Israel to permit delivery of humanitarian aid into the blockaded strip. The latest shipment on Sunday contained bicycles.
We are here for distribution of bicycles right now here in Gaza because the, you know, Eid al-Adha is coming. We want to make the children happy. And we want to show that we are supporting Palestinian people.
Another tradition that has seen some change this year is the annual pilgrimage to the holy sites of Islam in Saudi Arabia. Thousands of Iranians went to Iraq's holy city of Karbala instead of to Mecca, where hundreds of Iranian pilgrims were crushed in a stampede last year. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
We've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. You can find us on Twitter at VOA_IE. We're also on Facebook, where you can like our VOA Now page. Your director today was Patrice Martin, and the engineer was Keith Holmes. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. I'm on Twitter, too. You can find me at Michael_Lippin. I hope you have a great week, and I'd like to wish an Eid Mubarak to all of our listeners celebrating the holiday. Bye for now.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States welcomes the school year ceasefire recommitment made by Ukraine and Russia and witnessed by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, or the OSCE. To mark the September 1st beginning of the school year, Ukrainian and Russian authorities agreed to a ceasefire recommitment following a period of the worst violence seen since August 2015. Throughout the conflict, Russia has continued to arm, train, and fight alongside separatists in eastern Ukraine, and attacks by combined Russian separatist forces have killed 59 and wounded 319 Ukrainian service members since July 1st. A similar back-to-school ceasefire last year deteriorated within weeks when combined Russian separatist forces stepped up attacks on Ukrainian positions. This year, Ertugrul Apakan, head of the OSCE's Special Monitoring Mission, or SMM, has urged all sides to implement a full and comprehensive ceasefire. The fighting in eastern Ukraine has taken a heavy toll on the civilian population. More than 3 million people are in need of humanitarian aid, and more than 1.7 million have been displaced. The death toll stands at 10,000, of which 2,000 are non-combatants. Access to education and provision of psychosocial support are crucial to give hope to children and adolescents in eastern Ukraine, said UNICEF's Giovanna Barbaris. Far too many children have experienced traumatic events caused by the armed conflict. We need to help these children now to recover and move on with their life. Only a lasting ceasefire will allow these children to resume a normal life. It is crucial the SMM be allowed to do their job to verify the ceasefire and ensure the withdrawal of heavy weapons. equally crucial is for Russia to cease its destabilizing actions in eastern Ukraine, honor all its commitments in the Minsk agreements, and end its occupation of Crimea.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.